Welcome to The Weekly Trend, a podcast for navigating the markets through the lens of technical analysis. The Weekly Trend podcast is provided for educational purposes only and does not constitute any professional advice. Listeners should not act upon the information or content without first seeking advice from a registered financial planner.
Welcome back to The Weekly Trend podcast. Today is Friday, April 26, 2024. S&P 500 currently sitting at 5107. I'm David Zarling. Ian McMillan is on vacation. I'm here with a turkey slayer, Kevin Ferrari. You always do such a great job on these, so it's awesome that you agreed to join us on this episode. So thanks for doing this, Kevin.
Yeah, no problem.
I think this last week, you know, in previous episodes, we highlighted the normalcy of the abnormal. I know in the Lunch and Learn, we highlighted for clients and those interested in our process, the fact that how often does a once in 100 year event happen? Like, for example, weather. There's always that once in 100 year event that happens in weather. But if we're only looking at a localized area, not looking at the globe, because across the globe, a once in 100 year event happens every single year. So by definition, weather is normally abnormal, and our correlation or our metaphor or example there is markets are the same. Markets are normally abnormal. An example of that would be the frequency of 5% pullbacks in markets. That's actually pretty frequent, in addition to the fact that the average drawdown per year in US stock markets is minus 10%. Same with the average return positive on a per annual basis is 9%. So when we look at that from a behavioral perspective, you have to sit through minus 10 to get minus 9, even though both of those outcomes are the least likely outcome. So yeah, meaning
it's the real kicker, right? I mean,
go ahead. Like, I don't want to monopolize here.
No, just the fact that the average, right, is the least likely outcome, you know, that you're really likely to see just with, right, the way markets work, fat tail events. I mean, it kind of messes with your average number, right? Everybody pretty much knows how averages work. So that essentially boils down into averages not really being all that average.
It's an important aspect for investors and our listeners to remember is that when we're involved with markets, sometimes we forget why we're involved with markets because they can be painful. I'm not here to tell our listeners that the most recent 5% pullback in the market is comfortable or feels good. You know, for some accounts, that number minus 5% used on a nominal basis or a dollar-based basis might be a fluctuation that's equal to what they earned on an annual salary. And so putting context behind percentage moves versus nominal moves and what that means in your life as a retiree, it can be hard to see through that you would have fluctuations in your account that are equivalent to what you would make on an annual basis. But otherwise, knowing that it's okay for that fluctuation, because on the flip side, especially in an uptrend, like this volatility that we've recently seen, it's not like this is happening with a downward sloping 200 day. We're losing important horizontal levels. Well, we'll get to that in a minute. Maybe we are, but from a horizontal perspective, but we're definitely past 200 days of information, rising 200 day moving average. It's hard to comprehend this aspect from a nominal basis, a dollar based basis, that you'd have this much volatility, but it's perfectly normal. The reason why we're involved with markets to begin with is they're not meant to be entertainment. They're not meant to be your friend or something fun. It's about protecting your purchasing power. You know, when you enter and get near retirement, these things matter. You know, the cost of taking care of your livelihood, whether it's health or travel, food or transportation, these things are all divided by dollars. And the reason why you're involved with markets is to protect that purchasing power. If inflation's at 8% and you're sitting in something that generates zero, your purchasing power is dropping. I've got a little bit of a soapbox there, Kevin. I always like allowing who's ever on this with me to kind of direct where this potentially goes. What would you like to, in this past week of information that we got, are there some things that are sticking out to you that are noticeable and worth highlighting for those listening to this?
Well, I think just to your point, right, markets are no different really than, you know, anything else in your life. Really, it's just all about how you look at it, right? How do you frame your point of reference? Because I mean, I think technical analysis does a really good job of this, right? A really, you know, kind of a main point is like identifying your time frame. Or are you looking at more of the near term, intermediate term, or long term? Because really, right, you look at these charts, they all look different depending on what time frame you're using. And it can really kind of set your frame of mind differently, right? And I mean, it's no different for, you know, clients looking at performance, you know, just like you're saying, are you looking at it in dollar terms, which kind of, you know, are percentage return terms, you know, over what time period are you really considering this? And there's really a lot of ways to look at it.
That's a great point. You're saying while near term minus 5 to 7% feels terrible, mm-hmm. when you really zoom out and look big picture,
no big deal.
Perfectly normal ups and downs. And I love that you made the connection between everything in life, whether it's relationships or parenting or sports, you name it, everything has ebbs and flows. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you're in a season of change that doesn't feel good, and sometimes you're in a season of change that feels amazing. Markets are mirror that. And with a pullback that started in the start of April for something like the S&P 500, that when you bring up time frame, it's interesting because I almost wanted to use term peak to trough, but man, that's really hard because it's really a longer term time frame phrase. But to see S&P pull back 5.7%, for some, that might feel terrible, but we're here to remind people that's really, in the context of an uptrend, nothing.
Right. Yeah, and if anything, I think it kind of helps you identify some levels now that you can rely on for the next time, you know, we pull back, or as if we build out a range here.
I love that. You're saying, hey, what is price? If we're discounting price, if we're causing price to move lower, the economic law, supply and demand is in effect. There's more selling pressure than buying pressure to drive price lower. Now we're in what's called price discovery mode. Where are the buyers?
Mm-hmm.
And so we had this 5.7% pullback in something like the S&P 500. We saw some demand show up this week. Don't know if that continues, but your point is that's information. The fact that around 5,000, let's call it 4,970, 4,960 on the S&P 500, buyers showed up there. And that's worth noting.
It's like old school, right? Now you're back in the pit. Got guys calling out the prices. I mean, you're really, truly at the auction. You're who's bidding? Where are they bidding? Great way to find out information, right? That you can use as you hopefully move forward. I mean, because if you think, right, like leading up to kind of like your COVID crash, right, you really didn't have that opportunity, you know, to find those levels because it was like, boom,
Straight down,
falling off the cliff. So, I mean, these more kind of, I guess, controlled, if you will, pullbacks, right, really, I think, help set the table, you know, moving forward, how you want to, you know, really go about managing accounts.
Oh, absolutely. And when we talk about being able to identify horizontal levels where we see buyers show up, it's not unlike, to your point, showing up in any other auction, whether it's for buying cattle or you show up at the farmer's market and there's a price and there's a crowd, right? If a farmer shows up at the farmer's market with his supply, you know, I've got 30 watermelons, but yet all of a sudden the crowd swells to 50,000 people that want to buy that watermelon. Well, guess what? The price goes up.
Mm-hmm.
Or quite the opposite. If one person shows up, I don't need to hold on to all these watermelons. I'll go ahead and sell this one to you at a discount, Mr. Watermelon Connoisseur. And so this is what makes technical analysis powerful, is you're studying the supply and demand of the market. And when you consider what's happened in April, right, this pullback that's happened, I know this week has been positive and that's good and great. So was the pullback. When we look at seasonality, the best 6 months of any 12-month period typically is November through April. So November, December, January, February, March, April. Well, into March, we were up about 28% on the S&P 500 using that metric, measuring from November into the end of March. We pulled back and we're still positive 20%, even at the lowest point of this pullback. We're currently sitting at 25% for that six-month period. And that's one of the better six-month periods that we have on record. It doesn't normally unfold that way.
Mm-hmm.
it unfolds positively, that 6 month period typically is better than your next 6 months, your May through October, but not to this degree. So a pullback, perfectly normal, because we don't want trees growing to the moon. Well, maybe some do, because I wouldn't mind climbing a tree and then getting onto the moon, but I'd run out of oxygen.
Right. And say, bring a tank with you, but that would make it pretty hard to climb.
Yes, exactly. And then same thing with airplanes. At some point, they run out of oxygen when they climb that far that fast. So digestion and pullbacks are perfectly normal. We accept that information. And quite frankly, we're heading towards the end of a 6 month period that tends to be really strong. And let's not mince words, 25% S&P 500 over 6 months is really nice.
Yeah, it is.
Let's not complain. Let's just enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
Does it have to stay that same way? When we look at seasonality, Kevin, I know we had some things we shared before hopping on this recording. What are we seeing from a seasonal perspective that's worth keeping an eye on?
All right. Well, I know we kind of talked about this at the luncheon line quite a bit too, but you know, kind of to your point, right, with the beginning of the year being a little bit stronger, you know, at the lunch and learn, we like to cover, you know, like that early year trifecta with like the Santa Claus rally, first 5 days in January barometer.
Mm-hmm.
The saying, so goes January, goes the year. So positive January, right, which is nice. So, I mean, kind of things aligning there. And yeah, I know, you know, kind of your point, moving into this more late spring, early summer period, what is the saying that, what is it, sell in May, go away?
Yeah, that's an old market saying.
Mm-hmm. Which when you look at, you know, like these seasonal tendencies and like a lot of these composite charts, we do kind of tend to see a little bit more a flat period, maybe consolidation behavior, you know, around these time periods. And especially being, you know, in an election year, when you look at that, those kind of seasonal periods separately too, it kind of aligns there as well. So,
yeah, and I would say, I think you brought up a point about time frame. When we say, when the old mantra is sell in May and go away, well, the go away part, that's a time-based statement.
Mm-hmm.
Kevin's highlighting that when we look at election years, that, and when we look at this next 6 months, let's step back. Let's pretend it's not an election year. What we know is that the next 6 months tends to be weaker, mm-hmm, out of a 12-month, any rolling 12-month period. Our point being November through April tends to be the strongest. May through October tends to be the weakest. How it unfolds obviously varies. But when we look at election years, and then you add on a layer of saying, when you have a first quarter that was more than 5% up, it is perfectly normal to see corrective behavior April and May, but yet see a positive. It's one of the stronger 6 month periods of a weak 6 month period. I'm going to try to explain that again and try to clarify that and be succinct as I can for our listeners. So stepping back, the strongest 6 month period out of a 12-month rolling period is November through April. The weakest is May through October. However, when we observe election years and when we observe years where the start of the year was as strong as like this year, while you do see April and May be weak, from that point forward, we're really strong into October.
Mm-hmm.
About 78% of the time, we're positive about 3% during that time frame. So there's a drawdown, but there's a reclamation of that drawdown and move higher into the election. That wouldn't be surprising to see that unfolding before us right now, is that we would be weak into May, but strong into October. And so there's some of that sitting through volatility that people have to deal with, and that's okay.
Sure.
I mean, I wish I could make markets go in a straight line, Kevin.
Yeah, I don't know that we would necessarily have a job at that point if that's what they did, but
that is true.
It would be easier, that's for sure.
And would it be a market? Do relationships go in a straight line? Mm-hmm. Does life go in a straight line? Does anything in life go in a straight line? No. And so why would we have any expectation that's different for a body of individuals that involves human beings? You know, markets by nature. And some people would say, oh, what about the algorithms? Well, who wrote the algorithms?
People.
Right. You know, what about artificial intelligence? Well, we're not at self-learning and artificial intelligence yet. And maybe we will be. And I don't know the answer to that, but we're not. And whatever kicked that off was a human being anyway. And based on fear and greed, right? You don't write an algorithm to get poor in the market. You write an algorithm to try to capture gains in the market. And so the same concepts that have existed since the beginning of time, since Adam and Eve, fear and greed are what drives algorithms. And so I don't really buy the whole, what about algorithms?
And even how you execute on what essentially that algorithm's saying too, I mean, is like a statistical arbitrage idea where then you're trying to figure out how you're going to use leverage, I guess, to, right?
Time frame matters there too, Kevin. Like, I think that's such a good point that you brought up earlier, that is this algorithm written for the next 15 minutes? Mm-hmm. Or is it about scalping for the next 15 years? All the algorithms, and the beauty is they're all impacted on price. They're all the human intuition, the fear and greed, the opinions, whether they're shrewd or otherwise, are all involved in price. Mm-hmm. And that's what we see at the end of the day, is the impact that all of these things have on price. And the fact remains, price-wise, we remain in uptrend. We remain above 4,800 on something like the S&P 500. We have a rising 200-day moving average. And when we study how a 200-day moving average is created, right, we're literally looking back 200 trading days and dividing it by 200, and that's your average, and you're tracking that forward in time, that we're about to drop off a bunch of data that comes from August through October of last year. And that was a really weak period. So you're going to see an acceleration of a 200-day. Meanwhile, as you were alluding to before, this pullback and trying to identify where the buyers are, having a horizontal range with a rising 200-day is a really powerful combination. What else is worth highlighting for our listeners that they might find informative? I know in our show notes, you have a couple notes here on some really large cap stocks that might be worth paying attention to.
Yeah, Meta, I think you brought that up earlier, but kind of has a look like a potential island reversal, which is a little concerning, but we'll see here.
Meta being the ticker for Facebook, mm-hmm. which
I'm finally getting used to.
Yeah. Oh, so you are on it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That was always a curiosity for me. I am technically on it. I don't post. I don't look. I
do it for the memes.
You're there for the memes. Do you alphabetize your memes?
No, I don't print those out anymore.
That's great. Mm-hmm. So you would physically deliver your memes?
No, not anymore.
But you used to. Which I think is like another level. Like that's another, like if you stopped in my office and delivered a meme to me physically.
Like in an envelope with a stamp, like actually.
Yes. Yes. You would bring me back to the era of the late 90s when people are transitioning from memos to email. You're going to go ahead and send this meme to me in your office.
Yep.
I love it.
Like inner office fax. I'll have to figure out how to actually get it to print. I don't really know how fax machines work, to be honest with you, because that was kind of before my time.
Was that your transition period? You were definitely emailed. There was no such thing as memos. Were there faxes when you first started?
Yeah, but not in the traditional sense.
Okay.
It's basically like a weird way to get email, I guess, was kind of how it worked. It's just like an email with an extra step. So I never really got the point of it.
You took a physical piece of paper and turned it into an email is what you're saying.
Yeah, so you scan it to your computer, right? And then send the fax, which gets sent to somebody. Well, I guess I don't know how other people receive it, but we would get it as an email attachment.
Yes.
Yes. Internally, it's like an email with extra steps, but I don't.
Yeah. So everybody listening kind of knows where you and I exist mm-hmm. on the spectrum of generations. It is interesting to consider. I really don't use Facebook anymore. I have friends and family that absolutely do. That's how they check in with everybody. I do use the Facebook Messenger. We have a group chat that I appreciate. That's my family. But beyond that, I'm not really posting. I'm not checking anyone else's posts. But it looks like you got married, bought a house, have a child, that you're now on Facebook, Kevin. Is that how this works now?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think Facebook, when that first came out, was kind of like getting into the beginning of high school. So it was kind of always a thing. Because, I mean, when the first platform I got started with was MySpace, which.
Wait, you were legit on MySpace?
Oh, yeah. That was huge.
So you had like music playing in your background. Mm-hmm.
They had like the custom backgrounds, yeah.
What was your music?
I don't even know. I don't remember.
Oh, man.
I wouldn't even be able to guess.
Well, it even turned into a verb, right? Like when mm-hmm. Facebook became so successful, you got MySpace.
Right.
Wow, okay.
Everybody's first friend was Tom, man. Tom was the man.
Kind of like when you joined Twitter and Jack was your first friend.
Yeah.
And now you realize your true friend was Elon? Yeah. I see how it goes.
It's crazy how social media works.
It is. It's awesome.
Wild West.
we appropriately digressed. We got off track in a way. But when we look at Meta stock, Facebook stock, it had broken out to new highs on a gap being a gap in price, right? You have a closing price and you miss several points of price and you open at a new price. So there's a gap there. We recorded price for several weeks, maybe 2 months or something like that. And then we gapped down yesterday, Thursday. And
that's for both.
I'm sorry, say that again, Kevin.
Earnings events for both.
Yes, earning events for Meta and Microsoft. And so here we sit. Was that an island reversal in Meta? And that's just a technical analysis term for leaving an island of price, right? You have a gap, you have price recorded, and then you have a gap to the downside. And so you leave this island, right? There's of missing price, which sounds like a terrible island to be on. But anyway, I do think that's important to highlight. And Facebook's kind of the same, but it broke down and then it reclaimed an important horizontal level. So is that what would be called a false breakdown? But Meta is important because it's 2.3% of the S&P. You know, when you look at, we haven't talked about Magnificent Seven in a while. You know, you look at Microsoft, Apple, NVIDIA, Amazon, Meta, Google. These are the largest cap. They're tech-centric. They're communications-centric. And they haven't been necessarily the market like they had been in a previous year. We've actually seen these things pull back, while mid-caps and small-caps or things like energy have done well.
Yeah, like certain industrials are doing pretty good there for a while.
Yeah. And so it is interesting. On one hand, right, if you've got Apple below 168, or you've got a gap down on Facebook or Meta, that is information that you sit up and take notice, right? That's two major injuries in a market that's dictated by all-stars. On the flip side, you see semiconductors hold up well and something that's economically sensitive as industrials continue to lead. You have to take the weight of evidence. You don't get to just say, oh, because Meta has a potential island reversal or Microsoft has a potential false breakdown, that's it. It's just being aware of how these indices are weighted, that they're cap-centric, S&P is cap-centric, that you could see the S&P struggle. Meanwhile, there's other things that are happening underneath the surface, right? Because industrials is only 8.9% of the S&P 500. Meanwhile, technology is 30%. So you could see industrials continue to do well while tech is cools off. Right. And that's why we use technical analysis and relative strength.
Yeah, and to like point, I guess I've met it too, it's really not uncommon to see like these gaps come in, get filled, and then turn around and just continue, you know, with the main trend to move higher.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So it's, you know, kind of like the same theme of like the pullback, you know, just in the market overall, like 5% pullback. It's not uncommon to see these gaps filled and then turn around, move higher. I guess it's just, you have to note, I guess, the possibilities, right? If that isn't just a gap fill, you know, then what does that mean?
Right. Exactly. And I would say, you know, before we pivot to a different area of the market, meaning from an asset perspective, like in a moment here, we'll touch base on bonds and maybe some currencies, commodities, maybe some crypto. I don't know where we'll end up, but I will say from an equity perspective, right, it goes back to where are logical places for supply to show up again. And we're kind of at that spot for multiple indices and areas that we made new all-time highs. The highs that were established in late 2021 or early 2022, we just recently surpassed those, but now we've pulled back into them. And so now the question remains from a technician standpoint, are these false breakouts that now could reverse lower and turn into these massive double tops? Or is this normal auctioning behavior where we wrap around the prior highs in order to bring in the most, right? Because remember, there's another market participant involved in this, not just beside the buyer and the seller. It's the one who's providing the exchange to the buyer and the seller. Mm-hmm. They have money to make too. And the way you do that is you cause an auctioning process that involves the most buyers and sellers. And I don't view that as some like manipulation or evil thing. I view that as just free markets. That could we see an environment, a thesis where we're wrapping around the prior highs and we're just hanging around.
And that kind of fits that seasonal, you know, look kind of that we would be expecting. So, I mean, you got things that seem like, you know, you talk about weight of evidence, right? Are kind of potentially all aligning.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Like,
the picture.
We have a seasonal period of April and May in election years, and in election years that start off strong, that are weak, and we're just hanging around.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's worth highlighting. So with all this seasonal information that we have, the market doesn't have to obey seasonality, but it makes sense that we would see the market just hang around these prior highs and match the seasonality for April and May. It might make some feel good about the phrase sell in May and go away, but then we have to be careful because the next 4 months after that tend to be strong going into the election, regardless of who your favorite politician is. So where else you want to head? I know we talked equities. You want to cover bonds or currencies or commodities?
Yeah, I think we can pivot to bonds because I think it, you know, they kind of got set up somewhat nicely, right? We're kind of talking about, you know, I guess we think like relationships within the markets and kind of frame of reference in some of these averages, right? So I know like the 60-40 portfolio is one we talk about quite a bit and, you know, how well that's been working out lately, which has not been too well. So I know you were kind of looking into a little bit, you know, the makeup of kind of that 40%, right, a little bit.
Yeah, and I think it's important to highlight that, you know, you talked about MySpace. I brought up my exposure to that. I even brought up memos before emails.
TPS report.
Yeah, TPS reports. Even before that, if we step back as investors, right, because we're market historians, most investors, most money managers have been involved with a declining rate, rising bond environment since the early 1980s.
Yeah, so actually, it's just popped in my head. At the CMT symposium, which now I can't even remember when that was, but I think it was Louise Mata, right, that asked that question. Can't remember exactly right. How many of you were alive and, you know, within your career in practicing technical analysis in a rising rate environment? And there was what, maybe like 2-3 hands?
Right, correct.
Kind of wild to think about.
And really important to think about because markets are really good at wearing out your patience. And when you consider that you have credit or debt that typically operates on a 40-year cycle, that's most people's investable lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
What I mean by that is, you know, maybe if you're a unique individual, you're investing when you're 12, or maybe if you're unique, you're thinking about markets when you're 80. But typically these cycles exceed lifespans, or not lifespans, the majority of a lifespan.
Like your professional lifespan.
Correct. That's a better way to say it, your professional lifespan. And so here you had an environment from basically 1982 to, I'll say, 2020, 2021 of higher bond prices, lower rates. And because of this, and because of recency bias and confirmation bias, modern portfolio theory would say, hey, let's own some of this because it's non-correlated to stocks or equities. And therefore, you have an offset, you reduce volatility, you still collect some income, but you don't have the same volatility that you would if you were 100% stocks. Well, since 2020, 2021, that has changed. And that would be my big question to a lot of people listening to this. Is your advisor coaching you through this? Does your advisor understand that the 60-40 portfolio is now basically the 100 portfolio, that stocks and bonds are now correlated, that bonds move down and that can cause stocks to go down and you're in a rising rate environment. And so there's no longer this risk parity where you're offsetting the risk of equities with bonds. They're now at the same risk. And an example of that would be just this correction that took place in April here. If you want to call it from the very top to the low in April, S&P is down 5.5, yet we've got long-term treasuries down 6.7, and even aggregate bonds are down 3%. So there was no protective behavior from bonds for the equity portion of your portfolio. And our clients know that we don't operate this way. We don't own bonds for the sake of owning bonds. Kevin does a great job identifying in the fixed income universe where to be positioned. And maybe you can comment on that, Kevin. I think it's unique. I don't know that there's a lot of people talking about the bond complex and where there's strength. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Sure. And then it's just your point about correlations, right? That's really the risk of using correlations is they're not constant, right? Because then I guess it'd be more like a causational relationship there. And those things fluctuate over time. I mean, it might take a while for some of those, you know, correlations to kind of flip and change, but I mean, they do change, right? So you really kind of got to monitor those the same way you would, you know, just the assets or securities themselves. But right, like you're saying, you know, the kind of bond portion of the portfolio, right? Because what AGG is mostly, what, like 43% treasuries and, you know, like a quarter mortgage-backed securities, you know, if you're looking at these different areas of fixed income, that's definitely not where you've want to been, you know, over the past, you know, couple months, really. You're seeing kind of your lower credit quality areas, you know, if you want to be in fixed income at all, really the place to be, you know, so like your, you know, C's to triple C's to kind of get in and become some of your lower B credit areas, and even like other kind of risk off fixed income areas, like for a little while there, you know, like emerging market high yield bonds, you know, just things that traditionally you wouldn't think, right, to kind of include in that 40% fixed income sleeve.
Yeah, for sure. The 60-40 portfolio, 60% stocks, 40% bonds. It's not like advisors have clients tilted towards triple C credit. And to back up a little bit here, there's a ranking system for credit that's based on the likelihood of your repayment and meet your interest obligations. So you have anything from AAA, which would be your top tier, to your triple C junk bonds, which are your bottom tier. And what Kevin is saying is that when you look at that loaf of bread, they're buying the riskiest part of the loaf of bread. The investors, institutions are buying triple B, triple C credit, which is outpacing what is normally your triple A credit. Now there's two things going on there. Is that risk on, or is there something happening underneath the surface for triple A credit worth paying attention to? Because what we're really talking about there is US treasuries. So is there something underneath the surface? And I don't want to get down a macro wormhole, but the fact that they're that institutions are willing to buy triple C and triple B credit, typically you're more risk, taking on more risk when you buy that than you are triple A. That's information. And I'm guessing that most advisors don't even have the capability to identify when that's happening. And that's why we're thankful for technical analysis, because we can see when that's happening. We can see when there's areas in the credit market that are outperforming others. And that's information. Mm-hmm. Because if we're going to buy junk bonds and triple C credit over these other things, that's risk on behavior, which matches the risk on behavior we're seeing in equities.
And you don't have to sit there and wait for that, whatever that macro event may be or whatever that shoe is that falls to happen, right? I mean, you can see it real time in price and react to it.
Right, exactly. So the 60-40 portfolio, I'll never call it dead in the water. I'm not here to tell the market what to do, but the evidence suggests that the 60-40 portfolio is not doing what an advisor thinks it might be doing for his or her clients. The client may not understand the risks of a 60-40 portfolio. It's one of the things that we are able to identify for our clients is the inappropriateness of that methodology, because 40-year cycles do come to an end. We are in a new cycle. The evidence continues to support that thesis that we're in a new cycle of rising rates and lower bonds, and therefore the 60-40 portfolio is no longer really a viable risk parity aspect, setting up an investment model or setting up an investment account. What we could touch base on a little bit that probably doesn't get enough attention are commodities.
We kind of like to talk about it probably more than most. But well, I think the last time I was on here, we were kind of talking about commodities, because I think those, you know, we were touching on cocoa there a little bit and how crazy that's been going.
Cocoa.
But, you know, I guess broad basket commodities are kind of consolidating here. You know, just like bonds are just hanging around.
Just hanging around.
Yeah.
What are you doing? Nothing. Me? Just hanging around.
Nice layup there.
Yeah, I don't know how you deliver that physically, but it just got delivered, and I know we'll get it in this episode, but it's a digital meme. We've got things that are just hanging around.
Yep.
Whether we're looking at equities at prior price levels from 2021, 2022, and you were just about to pivot into commodities. So I'm sorry for that interruption, but continue on your thought.
Yeah, just, you know, I guess we're kind of talking about metals a lot lately, you know, copper's still pretty strong. Gold and silver, you know, pulled back a little bit, but they're still hanging in there, at least as of now. Cocoa's, I don't know what's going on there, but whatever's going on is still going on. Finally starting to see some life out of some of the grains, like corn, wheat, and rice, kind of more recently here, in kind of that shorter term time frame there, have been appreciating. So still some, you know, decent signs of the commodity space.
That's something worth paying attention to when we talk about higher grain prices and we talk about oil, energy, gasoline, and now you're talking about food sources like grains. And then you look at like a relationship like inflation protected securities versus your normal 7 to 10 year treasury. And here you have what looks like an inflationary environment back upon us. Mm-hmm. And do we really get to be surprised if bonds continue to struggle in that environment, that you would see higher rates? Because many would get focused on, oh, what's the Fed going to do with rates? What's the Fed going to do with rates? I make the argument the bond market already knows what's happening with rates and it's showing us the way before the Fed even moves. And here we're in an environment where we are seeing rates rise again, which means bonds are struggling again. And here we have an environment where commodities are starting to perk up. And that thesis of seeing equities wrap around, so from a price perspective, imagine jumping back and forth above and below a line, that line being their 2021 highs, 2022 highs. That's what we saw gold do for almost a year. Oh, I'm wrong. Way more than a year, like 3 years. We saw gold hover around its 2011 highs for 3 years, and now it's just breaking out to new highs. So you have this environment where you could see precious metals, industrial metals. Maybe we could talk about that a little bit. Like everybody likes to talk about gold, but what about Dr. Copper?
Yeah. And the copper's probably the strongest metal out there now. So hopefully it doesn't get to the point where I'm tearing out all the white copper wiring that's in my house and trying to take that in to sell it. But
or that someone else is tearing it out of their house.
No kidding. That's a good point.
And it is interesting to see, you know, things like Freeport McMoRan, Southern Copper, these are massive companies, but even some of your copper mining companies out of Canada, we are seeing tremendous strength out of industrial metals, things that are used for industrials. And you mentioned industrial strength from a sector perspective earlier. So are we really in a bearish market environment if we're buying triple C credit, triple B credit, buying economically sensitive things like copper, copper miners, and industrials? Probably not. The equity weakness that we've most recently seen being perfectly normal behavior, meaning sometimes in Wisconsin it snows and sometimes it rains in April, and that is normal. That is a normal precursor to a wonderful summer. Like there's nothing that beats a Wisconsin summer night, and those are on the verge of being here, but that doesn't mean we didn't have to have some snow and freezing rain and things that happen in March and April that are perfectly normal. And maybe that's what we're experiencing right now in April and May in the market. It's just perfectly normal volatility and pullback. And that's okay. So we talked about gold a little bit. You mentioned grains. And forgive me, I couldn't remember if there were specific grains that you were looking at. I know you mentioned cocoa. That's not a grain. That's a soft commodity. I don't know why. When I think of a cocoa bean, I don't think of it being soft, but regardless. Mm-hmm. Grains, is that across the board or is it one specific grain that you're looking at?
Yeah, I think corn and wheat more recently here. And I guess rice gets thrown in there, which is kind of one that throws me off too. But I don't necessarily always, you know, when you think of your traditional grains, rice doesn't necessarily come to mind. They've been doing pretty well lately.
That's probably a cultural thing, right? Like it's not like Americans are hand over fist trying to eat rice, even though it is good for you, but your point is made.
I don't drive by too many rice fields, I guess, going home. And, you know, corn, soybeans, maybe some wheat, that's about it. So definitely, I would think environmental for sure.
Yeah, environmentals. We have this environment of equities correcting both near term to the downside, this week not so much, potentially building a range that matches the seasonality that we've highlighted previously on this episode. You have bonds continue to correct, rates moving higher. You have commodities catching a bid in several areas. And when I say catching a bid, I just mean that demand is showing up for those. Currency-wise, trade-weighted dollar hanging in there. We have the Japanese yen, which, you know, if you're deep into market relationships, there is something about the yen and U.S. equities. Someone called it carry trade. I'm not expecting everybody listening to this to understand what that is. But can you talk a little bit about the correlation between, and we don't have to spend a ton of time on it. Mm-hmm. We saw a breakdown this week in the yen versus the dollar. Is there any significance there? What should we be thinking about with that?
I guess historically, as far as like correlation or relationship is concerned, I guess you would more so expect, you know, the yen to be negatively correlated to equities, you know, like the S&P, you know, kind of specifically. I think we used looking at this, but really that relationship is kind of reverted, you know, around 2016, 2017, really started kind of moving the other way to where it's actually essentially, at least as of today, become uncorrelated. So it's basically reached zero. So I don't know how many of you remember from your stats class, you know, those correlation coefficients move from positive one to negative one, where zero is, you know, essentially uncorrelated. You know, that's went from a pretty consistent negative correlation relationship to now, you know, zero and continue moving to actually being, you know, in the future, positively correlated, where they move in the same direction. I guess we'll have to see.
Are you saying only time will tell?
Yeah, just like everything else, right?
Man, you don't know the future, Kevin?
No, I don't think I do anyway. If I have known the future, I haven't realized it yet.
But if you said you knew the future and you gave some type of future prediction, it would make people feel really good.
Mm-hmm.
Don't you want people to feel really good?
I mean, that's usually nice, I guess. Yeah, with trying to guess and get it right.
Yeah, right. Like,
you know, depending on who you ask, you'd probably be surprised. Most people would probably give you the answer that bother me whether or not most people feel good or not. You know,
yeah.
That's my wife. I think she'll probably tell you I'm pretty indifferent to most things.
Yeah. And that's okay. And we don't have to have a prediction about everything.
Mm-hmm.
Even though humans love predictions and then make them feel better, predictions don't equal reality. And so we don't have a prediction for what the market can do. We do have a game plan. You know, if something like the S&P 500 is below 4,800, below a 200-day moving average, well, okay, maybe we have something we need to pay attention to, that sellers have control of this market. But until then, the trend remains up. We've talked about 4,180 how many times last year about needing to be above that, needing to be above the 200-day moving average. And here we are, you know, 25% later, we continue to see that uptrend intact. And so we covered a lot of ground, Kevin. We're not going to cut it off just yet. You have a note here in our show notes regarding some market mechanics, some plumbing, mm-hmm. on how markets operate. Can you walk our listeners through the market mechanic change that we're about to see in U.S. markets?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so if anybody out there is an active manager, I'm sure this has been something that you're keeping tabs on. So believe it or not, right, when you're transacting with the securities, buying and selling them, it's really not an instantaneous process like it seems to be. So really, you know, kind of how that whole settlement process works, at least now, you know, especially for, you know, equities, right? So like stocks, ETFs, things like that. There's like a 2-day settlement period. So they call it T+2. It's really, what is today? Well, we'll use Monday because that's way easier than dealing with the weekend. So you buy something on Monday, you know, that trade, regardless of, you know, the direction, is not considered settled until the second day. So it would be Wednesday, which probably doesn't sound like a big deal, but believe it or not, clients do eventually need and want their money, right? So when you have to, you know, sell things to make that money available, trying to get the timing of that figured out, or even just, you know, making changes within portfolios, right? If you're not holding a lot of cash, it can make things a lot more confusing sometimes than you really wish they would be. So what is it? I actually forgot the date now, but I think it's May 28th, I want to say. Does that sound right?
Yeah, it's the end of May where we're changing our trade settlement process.
Dude, yeah, we're going to T+1, which you're probably thinking, big deal, right? What's the difference? Well, things settle on next day. You know, it's really kind of a huge change. It makes things so much easier, you know, administratively, right? If you think of distributions and things like that to handle, making changes to the accounts, you don't really got to worry about, you know, your Reg T holdings and, you know, how long do I have to hold this if I want to move it out again? It's going to be pretty nice.
Yeah, things that most investors aren't thinking about.
Mm-mm.
that
I didn't even know that this whole Reg T thing existed until obviously working here. So
yeah,
and it's definitely not been a close friend of mine. T+2 has not been.
Yeah, and it's a kudos to U.S. markets that we can get to a trade settlement of 1 day rather than 2 days. It makes things better for the investor. It's a faster process. I really encourage our European colleagues to get aligned on this, that they also operate under this. But first, they got to get their exchanges to communicate with each other. Americans might take for granted, right? It's those things in our life that don't make noise that sometimes we don't appreciate and we should. And U.S. market participants should really appreciate the markets that are involved in on the U.S. side, because all of our exchanges communicate with each other. And in Europe, that's not the case. People might be surprised by that, but that you might get a price in Europe, in London, that's different than something that's in another part of Europe. That's surprising. Whereas in U.S. markets, you can go ARCA, NYSE, COB, you're going to see relatively basically the same price. And now we're adding just 1 day of settlement. Market mechanic wise, U.S. markets are bar none the best. And that's why investment flows here. And so I hope Europe can get on the same page. Asia can follow there as well. We're fans of fluid markets, but I love that you're highlighting that. And you're correct. May 28th is implementation of that. And people should be excited about it, even though this might be the first time that they ever heard that something like this existed.
Yeah, unless you're trying to navigate some of the headaches that that can bring up, you know, really it's something, you know, I guess, no real point for you to pay attention to. But, and I can imagine too, I would think custodians, right? Got to really appreciate this. Makes it a little easier on them as well, I would think. Trying not to have to track that 2 day settlement most closely.
Yeah, I think we should
be happy all around. It'll be,
it moves days
until the switch.
It moves closer to efficiency.
Mm-hmm.
That's good. That's an important thing.
For sure.
Anything else, Kevin, that you want to highlight before I highlight the ETF that supports this podcast? Anything else you want to touch base on that you think is worthwhile for those listening to hear?
I don't think so. I think I'll just hang around.
Just hanging around.
Mm-hmm.
So with that, you know, if you love this podcast, you appreciate it, please share it with others. You know, whether it's forwarding an email, sharing on your favorite platform, whether it's Facebook, MySpace, you name it, share it, give us a high ranking. But I also want to highlight the Adaptive Select ETF, which is listed on the New York Stock Exchange under ticker ADPV, which helps investors access two of the most prevalent factors in markets, momentum and relative strength. Through proprietary identification methods, the Adaptive Select ETF attempts to own the strongest 25 large cap stocks when the market is in an uptrend. And since not all market environments are the same, Adaptive Select seeks to prevent extended declines by moving to short-term treasury bills and cash during long-term market downtrends. Investors can find out more, including how to invest in ADPV, by visiting adpvetf.com or calling 1-833-880-5200. As always, investing involves risk, including possible loss of principal. ADPV is distributed by Quasar Distributors, LLC. Kevin, thanks for doing this with me. I hope you have a relaxing weekend ahead. My understanding is you're pulling off some solo dad moves this weekend.
For sure.
And that's admirable. And I know with the weather that's incoming, might have to do some of that inside, but that's okay. Anything else you want to highlight before we wrap it up?
No. Do you know, does ADPV have a fax number? Or is that not really a...
I suppose you could try. You could try sending a fax to 833-880-5200, but I don't know that you should expect a response.
Mm-hmm. And it would probably take me a while to figure out how to send a fax, so I'll probably just cut my losses now.
And I feel like that's a hard way. You're making yourself T+5.
At least.
You know, your settlement time is probably much, much longer if you submit your trade through fax.
Mm-hmm.
So not aware of a fax number for ADPV. I'm not saying there isn't one, but not recommending it. But perfect. Kevin, you always do an awesome job on this. Great job filling in. You always provide quality insight. And to everyone listening to this, we really appreciate you guys as well. Thanks for listening.
Yeah, thanks. Have a good weekend, everybody.